Case number 06-5035, Vernon Norman Earl, appellant versus Washington, D.C. Police Department et al. Ms. Hojaban for the amicus curiae, Mr. McKay for the appellees.
Thank you, Judge Griffith. My name is Stephen Goldblatt. I'm a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, and I was appointed as amicus in support of the appellant in this matter. With the court's permission, argument today will be presented by Jennifer Hojaban, a third-year law student at Georgetown who is appearing in conformity with the rules of this court.
Great.
Thank you.
Welcome, Ms. Hojaban. Nice to have you here.
May it please the court, I've requested 2 minutes for rebuttal time. This case has raised some complicated issues in this court, but it boils down to an appeal from an erroneous dismissal that occurred at the PLRA screening stage. The district court dismissed the complaint sua sponte before the complaint was even filed, and amicus submits that this procedural posture should limit this court's review to a determination of whether that dismissal was proper. Moreover, the complex issues this court is asked to decide are not easily resolvable and should be resolved in the district court under the rules of civil procedure. Even with the new evidence of Mr. Earl's escape, the question of when Mr. Earl's cause of action began to accrue is not obviously answered by the complaint. So even with the knowledge of the escape, it would have been inappropriate for the district court to dismiss the complaint at the screening stage. The question of the statute of limitations and the other grounds in which the District of Columbia, asks this court to decide the case are substantive and novel questions of law and fact. And in this case, deciding on an expanded record would put this court in the position of deciding matters that had no opportunity to be raised at the district court level. Because unlike a 12B6 motion to dismiss, this case was dismissed before it was even docketed or the defendants were even notified. And so in this case, the court is asked to decide matters that would put this court in the position of being a court of first instance. This court should address the basis of the district court's decision. That court reasoned that because Mr. Earl's complaint was filed 20 years after his arrest, it was barred by the statute of limitations under D.C. law. The court was correct to apply D.C.'s statute of limitations, but it failed to apply the complete analysis, including the tolling provision, which tolls the statute of limitations while an individual is imprisoned. Mr. Earl's complaint demonstrated that he was and still is imprisoned, and so based on the face of the complaint, which is all that was before the district court, the tolling provision should have applied, and the case should have been docketed.
What meaning do you give the language in 1915A, fails to state a claim upon which relief may be granted? That seems equivalent of 12B6, that's the exact language of 12B6. And that could involve a fairly complex legal issue. The Supreme Court handles cases involving the application of 12B6. So if, even though it might take elaborate and careful analysis to find that there was no private right of action, for example, wouldn't 1915A in its terms require dismissal by the court?
No, Your Honor. I believe that Mr. Earl's complaint did state a claim. It did not fail to state a claim. Certainly.
But that's because you assert that the convention does create a private right of action, right?
Exactly.
Suppose the ultimate conclusion on that is no, then it would be correct to dismiss the complaint, right?
Yes. If the Vienna Convention does not create a individually enforceable right, then the district court could have dismissed on those grounds. It did not dismiss on those grounds. It dismissed on the statute of limitations. And this court is asked by the District of Columbia to decide if there is an individually enforceable right under the Vienna Convention, but it is doing so without the benefit of the district court's reasoning. And
well, we do that sometimes. Let's say in an ordinary case when a bunch of issues are raised and the district court decides on one ground and we think that's no good, we're still free to look at other grounds that were properly raised, and if one of them was sufficient, we can rule on that.
Yes, this court certainly has the authority to affirm on other grounds, and I only mean to suggest that doing so in this case is particularly difficult because the case was dismissed at such an early stage, and the distinction I tried to make between 12b-6 and this dismissal is that the district court made the decision without the benefit of Mr. Earle's own reasoning, and it did so without applying the complete law. It did not apply the complete statute of limitations analysis.
But statute of limitations, let's suppose you're right entirely on statute of limitations. That would still leave other legal theories.
Yes, and certainly this court has the authority to consider those other theories. However, the question of whether the Vienna Convention creates an individually enforceable right is a complicated question. It's produced a circuit split. The language of the treaty itself is quite clear in referring to an individual's rights. And so I submit that it makes a difficult question of law.
It's more prudent for us to reverse and remand.
Is your argument basically the district didn't raise this until its opposition brief here, and the sides did not have a fair opportunity to engage on this issue?
Well, certainly the amicus was, only raised this issue in its reply brief because it was brought up
right.
by the
well,
district.
Well, I mean, that is a valid consideration to raise with the court, that the issue was never raised below. I can understand why, I guess, but nonetheless it wasn't. And even though we can do all kinds of things, not as much as the Supreme Court, prudence suggests that we ought not, since there are so many difficult questions here along with others as well, best let the district court sort it out with the parties fully engaged. That's what you're saying?
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. And Mr. Earle is asking for what he would have been given if the district court had applied the proper statute of limitations analysis. He would have had the opportunity to convince the district court of his reasoning and, if need be, to try to convince this court. Moreover, the statute of limitations issue depends on when Mr. Earle's cause of action began to accrue. This is a fact-specific injury into when Mr. Earle knew or should have known with due diligence of his injury. His injury in this case being that he was not informed of his right to have his consulate notified. Based on the record—
How does that work for torts of non-informing? They run until what? Until the injured person reads about it in the paper, or until the tortfeasor finally sends a note saying, whoops, sorry, or what? How does it work out, and are there cases on the point?
Well, certainly if the person is informed, then certainly
right.
the...
Certainly no later than that, but
yes.
I'm just wondering if where there's non-information, whether there's a risk of this statute never beginning to run.
Great case for your side, right? Great case for your side. The offense is you're supposed to give me notice, so that assumes I'm not supposed to know.
Yes, certainly the need for Article 36 itself supports a finding that the cause of action should not begin to accrue until the individual knows or should have known of the injury. if the foreign nationals could be presumed to know of their rights under Article 36, there would be no reason to contain a provision in Article 36 requiring that they be informed.
So you're not willing to concede anything more than actual knowledge. If the individual claimant, we have reason to know, they had actual knowledge of this right, then there's a problem. But other than that, you're saying, as Judge Williams suggests, it may run a long time.
It may, but I don't think actual knowledge is the only point in time it can start to run. We can presume at some point that Mr. Earl should have known with due diligence of his injury.
Really? And, how so?
Well, based on the facts we have before us, we might not be able to make that distinction now, but
I mean, that's an interesting hypothesis counter to your position. What do you have in mind? Maybe you want to back away and say, I'm just trying to be generous and not overreaching here.
I'd
back away.
I'm suggesting that the district court may be able to find, with an inquiry.
You can't think of anything.
Well, I would be able to possibly suggest that Mr. Earl had a immigration proceeding in the mid-1990s, and we may be able to reasonably assume that he should have found Rangel Gonzalez, which is the immigration case in which he learned of the Vienna Convention. We may be able to presume that he should have learned of that in the mid-1990s.
Wow, that's a generous position.
At any rate, the...
I think you know more than we do.
Yeah, right.
This is just underscoring the point that these are the very sorts of questions that should be presented to the district court in a case like that.
Right. Yes, Your Honor. And all the totality of these questions present substantive, novel questions that would be difficult for this court to address as a court of first instance.
No, this panel doesn't like the word totality.
Yeah, right.
We had a lot of that yesterday.
At least she didn't say totality of the circumstances.
Anti-totality panel.
My apologies, Your Honor.
No, sir. Okay.
If the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm James McKay and I represent the District of Columbia. This court may take into account Mr. Earl's unqualified concession in his pleadings before this court that he escaped from custody in 1988 and was free for 5 months before being recaptured in determining whether to affirm the district court. Under the D.C. Court of Appeals decision in D.C. v. Tinker, which is controlling.
Why is Tinker controlling?
Because
Tinker involved an escape, not a release.
It's controlling a fortiori. The Supreme Court has said that state law determines both the length of the statute.
I understand that. It's not the same case.
Well, it's a fortiori because the D.C. v. Tinker stands for the proposition that a defendant who is released, a prisoner who is released mistakenly, starts the running of the statute of limitation in Mr. Tinker's
case. And why is that the case? What's the reasoning behind that?
Well, because he is free to file a lawsuit in the D.C. Court of Appeals decision in Tinker.
And he's free to, and we want to encourage, if he has a claim, we want to encourage him to bring that claim within a timely period, right?
Well,
that's the policy behind it. How in the world, what does that have to do with a case where someone has escaped from prison? They're not going to be filing lawsuits.
A fortiori, and we cited several other circuit decisions where the prisoner actually did escape, and the courts held that tolling is equitable, and if somebody escapes, they...
I thought we were talking about Tinker.
Well, the Tinker case stands for the broad proposition that a prisoner who is mistakenly released, or in this case, an escape certainly is a situation when the prisoner...
You see no distinction between a mistaken release and an escape?
Well, he leaves custody, even though his leaving custody is mistaken, still starts the running of the statute of limitations.
Is that what Tinker stands for, is when one's out of custody?
I think so. Nobody has argued elsewhere so far in this appeal, and I understand that it is not exactly the same case, but the present case is clearly a situation that to which Tinker would apply. The whole point is that when Mr. Earl escaped, the statute of limitations started running in 1988, And it is true.
Now, that's circular. If Tinker applies, it does. And maybe no one has argued this before, but I think you have at least two people who are arguing it now.
Well, the point, the state law, in this case district law, determines tolling principles. And we do have a case, Tinker, that I think is very close to this, maybe not exactly the same, but it's a situation where there's a release, which was erroneous. Somebody leaves prison, and he shouldn't have left prison, and the court said the statute of limitations starts running. I think if this court wants to revisit the rationale of Tinker, I would just refer you to those two decisions of the other circuits that I decided
in
my brief.
We're trying to figure out what the rationale is and how it carries over in a situation from an authorized release as opposed to escape.
What's
the underlying rationale that you think clearly carries over into an escape situation?
The underlying rationale, Your Honor, is that the prisoner has left prison.
And authorized departure.
Whether it doesn't matter whether it's with authority or mistaken or illegal.
It may. It depends upon the rationale of the Court of Appeals opinion.
There. Well, the Court of Appeals opinion is basically somebody has left prison, and it doesn't matter why they left prison.
They say it doesn't matter why? Is that what Tinker
Well,
says?
Illegal or legal. It certainly, I think that stands for that proposition, that the Tinker case was a situation where somebody
legal or illegal. It's valid or invalid.
Whether valid or invalid, the point is that the person has left prison and he is no longer in custody. And that, I think, is the basic underlying rationale of Tinker. If a prisoner
is the next step, he's no longer in custody. Therefore, he is free to bring a case, right?
The point is that the statute starts running. He is free, whether or not it's in his best interest when he is in an escape situation to bring a case is another matter. But the two secrets
are... You're hearing yourself. It's not holding together.
Well, the Tinker case is basically the decision of the D.C. Court of Appeals.
Certainly we would be bound by it, but you're not giving us a convincing argument to indicate that this is the same situation as Tinker.
It's not exactly the same. It's a broader situation.
And Dukes and those other cases that you cite are merely an exercise of equitable authority. That's a different question entirely. That's something the district court does in the first instance.
Your Honor, let me move on to my alternative argument theories. I think Tinker applies, but if this court doesn't believe Tinker applies, this court should affirm on two alternative grounds. By the way, the district is raising these arguments at the very first opportunity. The defendants were never served, and the district basically raised the opportunity the first chance it had. And there are two alternative arguments. One is that the complaint, even liberally construed, does not suggest that the failure to advise Mr. Earle of his Vienna Convention rights was a result of a policy, custom, or practice on the part of the district government as required by Monell. It simply alleges that police officers who arrested Mr. Earle did not advise him of his rights. But
if there's any confusion on that, they certainly would be allowed to amend on remand.
Well, the PLRA required the district court to dismiss the case because the case failed to state a claim.
The district court did because of the statute of limitations.
Yes, but this court can affirm because there is no allegation on
We're not sure whether the complaint reaches it. We can remand, and the plaintiff would have an opportunity to amend to avoid any confusion. District court did not go on this ground, and I don't see why it's evident.
Well,
especially with pleading being as generous, the pleading rules being as generous as they are nowadays.
Well, even liberally construing it, all you have is an allegation: two police officers arrested me and didn't advise me of my rights, and that doesn't state. The district's not liable under Respondeat Superior for 1983. In addition, as this Judge Williams mentioned, this whole case is premised on the fact that the Vienna Convention creates a private right of action in the first place, an individually enforceable right of action, and five circuits have held that it does not.
Are there any any circuits holding the other way?
Circuit, Seventh Circuit holds it does. The five other circuits hold it does not.
So that means there's a discussion to be had.
There is a discussion to be had. I did cite this court's decision in McKesson, which supports some of the rationale of these circuits, the five circuits, to give five reasons for holding that there is no judicially enforceable right, individual right under the Vienna Convention, the general presumption against inferring individual rights, the language of the preamble, the language of Articles 36 itself, and the State Department.
Why should we reach that issue on this record? I mean,
pardon me?
Why should we reach that issue on this record? Why isn't this all better handled by the district court, which acted, you know, sua sponte, quite quickly, and
It's pure question
and
of
without,
law.
Without the benefit, let's put it this way, without the benefit of full briefing from the
parties. Your Honor, since there's only a questions of law that can dispose of this case, it would be, it serve no purpose, and it would be, a needless expenditure of judicial resources to remand. It would also be contrary to the policy of the PLRA to stem the tide of the non-meritorious pro se litigant prisoner cases in the federal court system. I think that there's absolutely no fact that this court does not know right now that is necessary for this court to decide this case.
Parties are allowed to participate in the deliberation with respect to complex legal issues. That hasn't happened here. That's one of the reasons. Just good sense and prudence says you let the matter, if there's a complicated matter, you let it start where it normally starts. You don't start at this level.
Well, this
raised it in your opposing brief. The other side has not had a fair opportunity with fair numbers of pages to fully engage that issue. And that's one of the reasons you send it back.
Well, Your Honor, I think the amicus has ably briefed all of the issues, and we bring them at these arguments for the very first opportunity we've had to bring them. And I think that they have been fleshed out fully, and I don't see anything really that we need to explore. We have the cases. We've cited all the relevant cases. We've cited the facts are not in dispute. I do not think that it would serve any purpose to remand. I believe that the alternative grounds that we cited, the fact there's no Monell liability even suggested in the complaint, liberally construed, and the fact that the PLRA doesn't even provide individually enforceable rights in the first place should dispose of this case, even if this court doesn't agree that Tinker disposes of the statute of limitations argument. Therefore, we would ask this court to affirm the district court, unless this court has any further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Does Ms. Hojaban have time left? We'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal, Ms. Hojaban.
Thank you, Your Honor. The only way Mr. Earle can get appropriate review is for this to be remanded, and we believe that it should be remanded. Unless the court has any questions about the issues the District of Columbia has raised, I will rest. Thanks.
Ms. Hojaban, as I understand it, you were appointed by the court to represent the appellants in this case, and the court thanks you and your fellow counsel for your assistance. Thank you. Case is submitted.